The following podcast contains adult subject matter. Listener discretion is advised.
Hey everybody, welcome to this special interview episode of Thinking Outside the Long Box. So there's this thing that I've always been excited about, and you guys hear me talk about it on the show, and that, of course, is Dungeons & Dragons. And so this episode, I am super excited to have Michael Whitwer on. Michael is one of the co-authors of Dungeons & Dragons, Art and Arcana of Visual History. This is an amazing book that, if you love D&D, you should have on your bookshelf for sure. Michael, how are you doing this evening, man?
Very well. Thank you for having me, Gabe. Really happy to be here.
Awesome. Well, so obviously I got to ask the first, big question. How did you get involved doing this project, creating this visual history of, what is beloved by so many people?
Well, thanks for asking. There's actually quite a bit to that story, really. I've been writing about D&D history now for the last few years. I wrote my first book published in 2015 that was called Empire of Imagination, Gary Gygax and the Birth of Dungeons and Dragons. So I've been kind of studying pretty deep dive D&D history now since about 2012 is when I kind of originally took on that project that turned into a book. That's a long story in and of itself. But long story short, Empire of Imagination came out in 2015. A lot of people in the industry really, really liked it. They really enjoyed this kind of narrative, dramatic telling of Gary Gygax's story, the person that co-created the Dungeons & Dragons game. And one of those people was Kyle Newman. Kyle Newman is a film director, and he's known for a number of things in Hollywood. Barely Lethal, before that, Fanboys is something a lot of people in our space know. And Kyle was a friend of my brother's. Sam is an actor in Hollywood, and they run in some of the same circles, and they're both big Star Wars geeks. They love Star Wars. So they had gotten to know each other over that. And as a result, Kyle and I were like Facebook friends. We kind of, tangentially knew each other, but I never met him. So what happened was somewhere, I think in early 2016, Kyle gave me a phone call out of the blue, really, and said, "Hey, Mike, I loved Empire of Imagination. I loved that story, blah, blah, blah." And he said, "Hey, I've got an idea, and I wanted to talk to you about it because, writing books. Where's the art book?" is what he said. And so, and I had thought about that a little bit because I'd been in the space for a little while. I mean, I've played the game since I was a little kid. So I've been in the world, my whole life, but studying it pretty deep the last few years. And when he asked that question, I was like, well, there's an art book, right? Like there's art books that have been done, haven't there? So I kind of dug around a little bit, and there had been like a couple of little art books by TSR that had been put out. That was the old publisher of D&D, the original publisher. And they were, but one thing I noticed about them is they were typically these promotional type of art books. Like they were like pumping whatever they were doing at the time. So if they were putting out Dark Sun in the early 90s, they would do an art book about Dark Sun sort of. But there was a Planescape one. There was a lot of interesting art books, but there wasn't anything comprehensive that really told the whole history. And so I remember I went over to Barnes & Noble actually after we had this phone call, and I started looking around. And sure enough, he was totally dead on. I was looking and I was seeing huge art books on like the art of Assassin's Creed and the art of Magic the Gathering, Zendikar and Innistrad and the Marvel encyclopedia and the DC visual, encyclopedia, whatever. And there was nothing on D&D. And I was like, wow, he's really onto something here. So I got back to him, told him I'd love to do this project. It actually seemed really viable, really interesting. But one thing I already knew from having been in the space and known a lot of the people that contributed to the game, both as designers and artists at that point, was that the actual artwork for this game is all in private collections all over the world. It's not centralized. It was such a homebrew game when it first came out that the individual pieces, especially one of his big ambitions was to feature the native art, the original artwork, without, trade dress and text bubbles, the way that most people knew it, to show it in that original way. Well, I knew that was immediately going to be something of a problem because I knew this art was scattered to the four winds. So the first thing we did is we built a team. We built a team that included my brother as my longtime dungeon master and my entrance to the game, who, of course, was a mutual connection between me and Kyle. And he's just a great storyteller and just knows everything ins and outs as a dungeon master from that perspective. And then, of course, my friend and colleague and really the kind of the top D&D historian on the planet, John Peterson, who wrote this wonderful book, Playing at the World, in 2012, which was a major important source for me writing my work later in 2015. And John's just a great friend of mine. And importantly, he's also not only a great historian, but he's a collector. And he has a lot of access to the collector circles. And we knew we would need that going in to try to do a project like this if we were going to really do a comprehensive art book and try to find a lot of these original pieces. So there's a lot I could tell you about how this kind of all coalesced, but the short version is that I went to some of my colleagues at Wizards and approached them about this, and they got me in touch with the publisher over there, a wonderful woman named Liz Hsu, who got back to us right away, and she said, "Hey, I love this concept. I love what you're thinking about here. You know, we're not really doing art books right now. You know, we're doing game books right now here at Wizards of the Coast, but you're in luck. Penguin Random House called me last week, basically, and they wanted to talk about doing a book like this." So she hooked us up with 10 Speed Press. That's the imprint. And we had to deal with this very, very quickly. And kind of the rest was history. From there, really, the team really put our heads together and then figured out what the scope of this would be. And really, at the end of the day, we're really pleased to say that it's much more than an art book, I think. It's really a complete visual history that has a whole bunch of art, a whole bunch of art history, but a lot of other things, too.
You know, it's fascinating looking through the book. There's so much that digs into the past of Dungeons and Dragons and then pulls it into the present as well. Like, you know, you have these kind of splash pages that have effectively the visual history of like specific monsters like the Beholder or like the Roper and things like that. What were some of the most interesting things for you to find like about the history of Dungeons and Dragons as you really dug into it?
Well, yeah, one of the most startling things as we really dug into the visual history, and that was a very important distinction, by the way, right off the bat, was realizing that an art book in and of itself is an abstract, it's not an abstract concept, it's a complicated thing to execute objectively correctly, if that makes sense. Art is so subjective. What we realized, the first thing we did is we pulled out all of these different pieces that we all liked, that all resonated with us individually. And there was a lot of overlap on pieces that were kind of objectively important, and I'll talk about that in a second. There was also stuff all over the place that was basically stuff that just spoke to any given individual. And we figured out right away, wow, we're going to have a lot of trouble if we're just kind of arbitrarily curating these pieces, putting them together and kind of writing captions. That's going to be really challenging, and it's going to be hard to really defend how we chose what we did. So what we figured out pretty quickly was that no, we have to really start with product, and really one way we can curate right off the bat is that the pieces that had the most eyeballs on them were some of the most important pieces to their visual history. That is to say, they inspired more people than anything else. They were more visible. So we could at least kind of start with the idea of hyper-successful products, the covers of those. We could kind of narrow those down and say, these pieces are very important. If we can find these originals, this is a good place to start. I'll give you an example. One of our original objectives was to find the original 5 wraparound Advanced Dungeons & Dragons covers. Partly because they were because they were hugely successful books that really kicked off the brand in a very mainstream way, but two, the covers had never been seen; they've never been published in their native form. So we knew that it would be really high value if people could see these things without the text bubble and the trade dress and without the you know that wraparound spine that really kind of got in the way of the art. So we went through this really kind of long and arduous curation process and scoping project to figure out exactly the book we wanted to write, and we figured out also really quickly that when you're telling a visual history, art is only a piece of many. Period advertisements, original drafts, dice, pictures, of course, of product and players and people. You know, telling a full visual story, that was a much more appealing concept than just featuring art. So that was another piece that really kind of fed into a much more ambitious work, a much more comprehensive work about really telling the entire tale of Dungeons and Dragons as told through its visuals. So that was really where we kind of went. But to answer your original question after taking that long rabbit hole was kind of what surprised us when we started approaching the piece like this. And I will say right off the bat, one thing that was really amazing and remarkable One of the things I'm most proud about is that we've been able to shed some light on some of these early artists who had really kind of disappeared from D&D history. No one had ever kind of talking to them and getting their story. And they're responsible for really the first people that tried to help us define the visual vocabulary of Dungeons & Dragons when it was really just an amateur homebrew game. So what was startling is that when you found out, when you looked through these original pamphlets, which again are very crude, they're very homebrew. And in fact, they were like self-published and homemade. You know, they were hand-assembled by Gary Gygax and his partners in his basement. And these original artworks are usually pen-drawn, and they're really crude, relatively speaking, and only to find out these were all done by like local amateur artists, mostly that were in their teens. So locating these people and being able to give them some credit was a really, really special part of this project for us. Finding out who was Keenan Powell. Keenan Powell was Gary's sister-in-law. We didn't know whether Keenan Powell was a man or a woman, or whether that was a local person. Who was Cookie Corey? Who was Greg Bell? Who was this Greg Bell person who signed all these original early D&D art pieces? Well, Greg Bell was a local teenager from Rockford, Illinois, 17-year-old, who Gary would pay $2 per panel to do these original D&D pieces. So Tracy Lesh, another early D&D artist, 14-year-old kid who happened to be in history class with Gary's daughter in junior high. Like, finding out the original history of the game was that homebrew and that amateur was really exciting. And then being able to actually give a context around, you know, for a long time, a lot of, you know, people would look at these early panels and say, oh, those are so crude. And look, they were kind of copying Marvel panels and stuff like that. And then to be able to find out, yeah, they were. They were like young kids. They were getting paid $1 to $2 to do these panels on short notice. And to find out that that was the context around these was magical for us, just to kind of shed new light on that history.
So when you contacted these artists, was it kind of out of the blue? And were they really surprised to be contacted about their previous work in Dungeons & Dragons when they were like 14 and 15 and stuff?
The answer is yes, absolutely. They were shocked that anybody cared enough to like go and find out who was the artist behind that. And you know, you have to, one piece of context that's important is a number of these people actually went on to be professional artists or semi-professional artists or artists in other capacities. You know, they went on to be writers and other things. And so there is, I think there was a certain amount of not embarrassment, but kind of like, you mean, I think you and I could imagine. Could you imagine somebody pulling out something from that we did in high school or earlier that's been like saved for posterity because it's in these important early collectible books now, you know, and basically saying, hey, look at this great thing you did. And remember the context around this, you know, and I always try to remember when I'm dealing with these early D&D important people, designers and artists alike, you know, they didn't always realize they were making history when they made it, right? They were just given some assignment, you know, for this homebrew thing they never thought would probably go anywhere. They probably didn't even have the full context about what they were drawing for. So I think there's a certain amount of ambivalence people approach with this because they're like, wow, that is pretty amateur and crude, but I did it when I was 12, you know, or 14 or whatever. Right. So I think there's a certain amount of that. But I think overwhelmingly what we've found is that people are thrilled that this history is kind of being dug up and that they did this thing that they probably didn't think much of at the time, but it's connected to this really important, amazing visual tradition now. And they were the first ones. They were the pioneers that were the first people that had to define what a mind flayer looked like or a beholder. That's really cool. And in some cases, I don't think they realized that. They didn't realize, wow, I was the first one that had to depict a so-and-so in the D&D universe. That's really cool. So again, that was one of the single coolest things that is part of this project was finding these people that really had been kind of passed over because again, what really happened was as D&D got more and more successful, they were able to hire, you know, real trained artists later on. And by the time the game really got successful and reached the mainstream, those early people were long, long gone. And nobody had ever seen those original books by and large. So to be able to kind of dig that back up was just awesome.
It's funny, you know, I've been showing my kids, you know, in preparation for this interview, I was showing them the book. And then I also was showing them, I have a fairly large collection of like old original Dungeons and Dragons. And of course, advanced and third edition and stuff, not fourth edition, mm-hmm. though. That was terrible. And, you know, I was showing the old monster manual to my son. He's like, wow, this, I could draw this. I was like, yeah, like you could have that, you know, the guys that were drawing this, they were kids when they first started this. And, you know, the guy that founded it, he created it in his home. It wasn't like a codified real thing until years and years later. And it's just fascinating to be able to look back on that.
Well, and that speaks in part, Gabe, to this notion that a lot of the stuff we were able to find and unearth, and we can talk more about this certainly, but what was so thrilling about finding like original draft material from D&D, the notion that that Gary or anybody else even bothered ever saving a draft piece that didn't appear in the original brown box or whatever that was developed for it, because again, they didn't know they were making history, but furthermore, they weren't very good pieces, you know, objectively as art pieces. So it's amazing they just didn't crumple them up and throw them away.
Yeah.
There was draft pieces and original campaign materials, all this stuff that has somehow survived the test of time, and being able to feature stuff like that was, again, it was thrilling, just thrilling.
It's fascinating to think about, like, just some notebook somewhere, you know, Gary Gygax had like this campaign setting that he had developed or this adventure that he had developed. And somebody was like, man, I should hold on to it. That was really fun. And now it's part of like this history of this pop culture phenomenon, like, you know, Dungeons and Dragons, you know, went from being the most dangerous game that you could play around the kitchen table to featured in one of the most popular Netflix shows of all time. It's really fascinating, like the journey that the game has taken and just the way it has developed itself over time.
Well, and I think that's what really spoke to us when we realized the opportunity of not just making an art book that would give all this early context and show these original pieces as well as they've ever been shown and published. That was certainly, those were high objectives. But one of them was like, wow, the arc of this game is stranger than fiction. It's remarkable. It's for so many reasons. There was mistakes of history that happened that propelled this game to the mainstream, namely the Satanic Panic, something that the game could have never planned for. It's an amazing story, and it's one that you just couldn't even make up. And knowing that we could tell that story largely through visuals, and I'm going to use my co-author and partner's term for this, we wanted this book to work with the sound off. We wanted it to be such that you could literally flip through it and get the gist of not only D&D's visual history, but kind of the story of D&D, starting as this crude homebrew pencil sketch type of game that turned into, you know, something a little bit more sophisticated, full color artworks, going into this generation of some of the actually the best fantasy artists in the whole industry. When you start really around 1981, 82, when they start getting people like Larry Elmore and Jeff Easley on staff, the Dragonlance, and all of these things that start to kind of coalesce. And it goes through this whole arc, and then it has this rise and fall with the advent of Magic the Gathering, which ends up kind of eating its lunch, eating really the whole hobby community's lunch, really, because it became such a successful game and kind of stole all the dollars from the industry. Then they're acquired by that. And, you know, and so you'd even mentioned a fourth edition earlier in this conversation, seeing what fourth edition was even trying to accomplish. That has a very interesting context. And it was not from arm's length. What I would say about even that choice is it wasn't a bad idea about what they were trying to do. There was a number of factors that kind of made it not quite work, execution and other market pressures. But it's so interesting to see that. And having studied the game now like that, and again, the visuals tell you just so much about what they were trying to do as a company, what was going on in the industry. So it's just an amazing story. And that was just really a goal of ours, is to make this book work with the sound off. It could work as a flip through. It can work as something if you read it, decide to read all 60,000 words, by all means, 50 to 60, whatever it is. But yeah, it was really fun in that way.
You know, it's great looking through it. You know, you talked about the importance of the advertising and stuff. And I remember that, you know, the giant red dragon on the back of my comic books and then the TSR logo. And it was so iconic. And I would literally spend like math class drawing it as opposed to doing my actual homework. So, you know, those images were so important and indelible to like my childhood. When you were digging through this, when you were kind of creating this amazing like history, you know, did it drum up all those kind of memories? Like how many nights did you guys just spend nerding out about stuff that you loved when you were kids?
Oh, I mean, that was a lot of it. I mean, that's really where the project started when it came to that first kind of pull of art that all resonated with us. And again, it was all wildly different stuff in some cases. But that's because we all poured over different stuff. I mean, for me, it was like the Jeff Easley 1983 Orange Spine core books. The covers of those were some of the best that Easley and D&D had ever put out, in my estimation. And then that all goes all the way through like Unearthed Arcana in 85. Just these really interesting pieces that featured wild characters and really immersive scenes, right? Like I think about Unearthed Arcana, this notion of the wizard sitting in his laboratory with beakers bubbling all over the place and a little baby dragon in one of the vials, and just all of this different stuff. And and this book of unspeakable knowledge in front of the wizard that's glowing. Things like that just really captured my imagination. And it did for an entire generation of fantasy lovers and D&D players, certainly, right? So we all had that experience. I mean, we were all passionate about that. But I will tell you, Gabe, where the rubber hit the road of this project is where we actually started finding these original pieces and then being able to see them either in person or in some cases via high-resolution photography. If we had, for example, found a collector that had it and set up and arranged to get it photographed so we can get to see it in person. Most of the time, we actually did get to see these things in person. And it was amazing to be able to see it down to the brushstrokes, see this piece that was so iconic that we knew so well. And yet when you see it in person, the original, its size, its brushstrokes, it is so much more vivid and amazing than you ever imagine. And in some cases, gave you an entirely new respect for artists that at one point, I can speak for myself, artists that you thought were, they weren't great artists, or like they didn't have like the best execution. You know, I'm not an art critic here, but you know, I can judge, you know, if someone's kind of borderline amateur versus someone's highly professional. But then you start to see their original pieces and some of the things that they were clearly trying to do and execute. And you're like, wow, this is hugely ambitious. What an amazing idea. What an amazing piece. So I can tell you, one just off the top of my head that I'll never forget, when it was one of the first ones that we had kind of come across. It was the original Monster Manual painting. And one thing that was notable about that was one of those five I was talking about, an original Advanced Dungeons & Dragons piece that was only and ever published on this wraparound cover in 1977 on the Monster Manual. And the wraparound cover, again, they're notoriously, the printing quality was bad to begin with in terms of color and all the other things. And of course, it cuts off an inch on the top and the bottom. And then it's wraparound and it's got the trade dress on the front. It's got this spine in the middle. So right in the middle of the painting, basically. And then this big text bubble in back. So effectively, nobody had ever seen this piece the way it is. And I was digging around an online forum and it had found at one point that this piece had looks like it disappeared at auction around 2000 to a fellow named David Mandel. So I thought, okay. So I started digging around David Mandel and I found that this may be the same person that had written this other book that I thought was amazing a couple of years ago. It was a Ralph McQuarrie book. A huge tome by Abrams, I think, is who put it out. And it was this Ralph McQuarrie art book, that all this conceptual art, whatever. And I thought, this is probably the same person. I bet this person is like a fantasy and sci-fi art collector, and I bet this is the same guy that co-authored that book. So we dug a little deeper, and I figure out the person that co-authored that book was, in fact, the same person. Also, the same person who was the showrunner for Veep. So he's a screenwriter and he's a showrunner and producer and brilliant, brilliant writer. He's the one that wrote the Bizarro Jerry Seinfeld episode, if you ever saw that. It's a huge story for Seinfeld. So this is the same David Mandel. So we're thinking, wow, I wonder if this person still has it. So I reach out to Kyle, who of course lives in Hollywood and knows a lot of these people. He's very much in that business. And I said, Kyle, do you know this David Mandel fellow? And he says, well, I don't know him personally, but we're Facebook friends. And I know a lot of people that do. So he literally reaches out over Facebook, makes a phone call or two. And then within a day or two, he's in touch with David Mandel. He's thrilled to help. And he's got like 50 wonderful pieces. And he agrees to get them professionally photographed for our book. And when that piece, the Monster Manual in particular, when that piece showed up in our inbox, it was chills for all of us, literally chills. Because the detail, the level of detail, the level of color and composition, everything about it was just staggering. And it was so wildly different than anything we'd even recognized from this Monster Manual that we knew and loved so much. That was just an amazing way to kind of kick off this big discovery process, this archaeology process is what we call it, to find these pieces and kind of bring them to high resolution in this book.
That's so fascinating. Like what... Yeah, the one question I kind of have about it is how physically big is the piece? Like it never occurred to me that, I mean, it might be way bigger than I think it is.
Those wraparound covers are, I'm going to do it with my hands here. I'm going to say they're about 3 feet wide by, call it 2 feet high.
Oh, that's cool. Like,
I'm kind of measuring with my hands in air right now, but I know the size, that's about the right size.
That's awesome. Like, you know, you think about the book and, you know, when you see a comic book page, obviously it's like shrunk down to be like a specific size. And it just occurred to me, this is probably bigger than I think it is. That'd be so cool. Like, I can't even imagine what it'd be like to own a piece of history like that, let alone just see it, you know? That's fascinating.
Well, you know, and we knew where a couple of these pieces were going into it. I mean, we'd be crazy to even take on a project like this if we didn't know really where to start. And because John and I have been in the D&D history space for quite a while, we really knew a lot of the collectors and a lot of people that had owned this stuff. And one of them is my good friend and colleague, like Paul Stormberg, for example, who is a great D&D historian, and he's an auctioneer, and he owns the Dungeon Master's Guide. That great big red efreet on the front of the 1979 Dungeon Master's Guide. And I'd seen that a number of times because Paul had taken that to like Gary Con and other conventions before. And so, you know, there was pieces like that we knew where they were and that we would be able to get access to things like that. Another one, like the original basic set, Sutherland Red Dragon, we knew that Wizards of the Coast actually found that a couple of years ago in a dusty warehouse. Literally, it was like, think like Raiders of the Lost Ark, you know,
yeah.
the end of that. Like it was like leaning behind a box in a warehouse, and some people had discovered it there. And what happened was one of the people that works in kind of distribution and management, a guy named Kurt Gould, who John and I know, John knew before, who is also a collector. He like overheard these people talking about, yeah, we found this weird dragon thing, and he knew exactly what it was. So Kurt ran over and got it and brought it to the art director at Wizards, and they saved this piece. So there was a lot of things like that we had been kind of aware of over the last few years. And then again, the rest was really kind of looking under rocks. And every time we turned over a new rock, two or three other pieces would inevitably show themselves, or other individuals would get connected with us who had just amazing things. And people were just hugely generous with their collections to let us, you know, either photograph this stuff or scan it or kind of get access to all the stuff we needed.
That's awesome. You guys made your way into, I think, every D&D kid's dream job. I'm going to hunt down all the coolest things.
Oh yeah, I mean, it was just an unbelievable project. And the only thing I wish is I wish we'd had a little bit more time, because it was a grueling project as well. You know, consider that this thing took 2 years to do. We have four authors, right? So there's a lot of work in that in terms of research and doing interviews and, of course, the writing and then the finding of these things and kind of the process of permissioning and getting all of the proper imagery in place. It was really quite an effort that took a big team like this. And it took that whole time. And consider that was based on a lot of other work. You know, John's been doing this for over 10 years, me for over six. So we had already kind of been doing this type of work, but not in the art arena, right? So we at least knew the first phone calls to make and get us, you know, a head start. Because without that, this thing would have taken 5 years, even with the four authors, right? So it was a pretty amazing project. And again, it was really based on it wouldn't have been possible without just a wonderful, generous group of collectors, people like Bill Meinhardt and Matt Coder and a lot of others. And then people that were willing to tell their stories to us, the original designers and the original artists that really shared some wonderful insights.
You know,
and of course, John's collection. I can't leave out the fact that John, as a collector, has really unique, wonderful things. And he wasn't an art person. He was more interested in collecting early drafts and memos, original sketches. For example, you'll see like Gary's original Hamlet map from 1976 is in there. That predates the Hamlet module by 3 years. The Tomb of Horrors, you know, module in there that we found from a different collector, that thing predates the published Tomb of Horrors by 4 years. So being able to find draft material of really iconic stuff was really, really fun.
Oh, that's so cool. And it, you know, like I had said earlier with, you know, the advent of like the Death Saves clothing line and like, mm-hmm. you know, fifth edition coming out, you know, Stranger Things putting a new light on Dungeons and Dragons. I just read an article about how Tom Morello runs a campaign for the neighborhood kids. Like D&D is kind of coming into its own and getting the chance to like really flourish where it couldn't back in the 80s because people were afraid you were summoning demons. So like this This is like perfect timing for this particular book, I think.
So, you know, I just saw that, by the way. And there's a lot of musicians and rockers that love this game. There's a lot of, you know, like Moby is one, for example. Moby actually Instagrammed about our book when he found it at a store, you know, and you see this. You see this. There's a lot of people, a lot of role-playing gamers in the music space. A lot of these musicians were, you know, as Joe talks about it, you know, Death Saves, you know, one of his dreams with Death Saves, right, was to the idea of letting this idea of how like peanut butter and jelly in the 80s was like, you know, these like rock, you know, Iron Maiden type t-shirts going along with D&D, this game that was rumored to be satanic and all that stuff, you know? And so this was kind of this thing is like, you were this kid that was kind of counterculture. You'd play your D&D, you had your like Iron Maiden posters and stuff on the wall and Motley Crue. And like, this is kind of what, this was your culture. This is what you were into.
It still and, is.
And, well, you're right. Exactly. And it's all kind of making a comeback. So it's really kind of a fun time for the game.
I basically haven't progressed past about 15 years old. I just wear metal band shirts and play D&D and do a podcast now. So, but so as we wrap up, let our listeners know, like, where can you find this book? And I know there's a couple different volumes, like, or versions of the book that have some really cool extras to them.
Absolutely. Well, thanks for asking. Yeah. So the book has three distinct editions that are all available pretty widely. I'll get to that in a second. So there's the standard edition, which is the Larry Elmore dragon from the basic box, 1983, this iconic red dragon attacking this warrior or vice versa. And that's got a black cover on the top and bottom. And then there is the Barnes & Noble special edition, which is the exact same cover, but it's red on the top and bottom instead of black. And that edition has got a couple of additional pieces of content, and that's, of course, only available at Barnes & Noble and on their online site. So there's the Barnes & Noble edition, which is very similar to the standard. They're both wonderful editions. The standard edition is available very widely, any online retailer, and most friendly local game stores will have the standard as well as the special edition. So the special box set edition is a third edition that's a different price point. It's quite a bit more expensive, but that one is in a special box set. It's this big clamshell box set with this wonderful original artwork by Hydro 74 on the front, this big gold dragon, amazing thing. Hydro 74 does a lot of these special edition artworks for Wizards of the Coast these days. And that book is pretty much the same as the standard inside, but it comes with some more goodies inside in the actual box set. For example, a number of prints of the art at high resolution that are suitable for framing or hanging, posters, et cetera. And then something that was really special and a really wonderful find, actually, which is a story in and of itself, but a facsimile copy of the 1975 tournament edition of Tomb of Horrors. What that is Gary's original typewritten pages, notes, and his hand-drawn map, along with 24 panels by 14-year-old Tracy Lesh, who did all of these original panels that became the basis for the super iconic panels of the 1978 published edition of Tomb of Horrors that everyone knows and loves. This is the original tournament version for Gary's own tournament at Origins 1 in Baltimore. This thing is just an amazing relic, and it's got a tremendous history, not only because it's such an iconic module and you're seeing the original version of it, again, in Gary's, you know, typed pages, but these original panels by Tracy are just incredible. And seeing that these were done, you know, on short notice by this 14-year-old local kid and how they inspired these later pieces, it's an amazing little artifact that we were able to find as part of our research. And that's a special little piece that for people that are really like Tomb or into the really crunchy history will really like that.
Oh, that's so cool. Like it's one of those must-haves for me. Like, I'm definitely picking this book up. It's so cool looking. Like, just all the extras in that special edition absolutely are amazing to me.
We really had a lot of fun with it. I mean, it was a thrilling thing to be able to do multiple editions and be able to make them all a little bit different. And so again, these are widely available on all the online retailers, Barnes & Noble, brick and mortar bookstores, and of course, friendly local game stores. They're pretty widely available at all those places. And actually, you know, one thing, if you don't mind, a quick plug, we've got, I'm really humble to say that the book was nominated for a Locus Magazine Award, which is something that we're really excited about. That's a big fantasy and sci-fi magazine that we've all known and loved. And we've been nominated for the best art book category. So I believe that's open for the next couple of weeks. So if anyone likes the book and they're inclined, we'd love for you to support the book via voting for us on the Locus Magazine Awards. That's just something you can do online, no subscription required. But we're really thrilled. It's been the reception's just been amazing for us.
Well, I hope you win it because that's awesome. I went and voted for you guys when we had talked earlier. So
thank you.
I'm super stoked for the book. Like it's absolutely beautiful. You guys did a fantastic job, like bringing to life a history of something that has been near and dear to my heart for a very, very long time. So thanks for coming on the show to talk about it. And of course, thank you so much for doing this for the rest of us, because I mean, I don't know any art collectors, so I only know comic book collectors. I've seen some crazy comics, but I've never seen original Dungeons and Dragons art like you guys have. That's fantastic.
Well, thank you. I mean, this book was truly our privilege, and it was really our honor to be part of this and have the privilege of doing it. And really, the people that deserve all the credit, and this is never lost to me, the people that really do all the credit are the original designers and the artists who actually did the work. You know, we have the benefit of just writing about them and featuring their material and kind of putting it together. But they're the ones that did the work, and they're the ones that really created this incredible, rich visual history that we get to all enjoy now. So, you know, obviously a huge thanks to all of them.
Awesome. Well, thanks again for being on the show, man. I really appreciate your time. And this is, I mean, listeners, go pick this book up. It is absolutely stunning. You will not be disappointed.
Thank you.
Well, there you have it, another interview episode. Man, like, it's so cool to be able to sit and talk with somebody that has, like, dug so deep into the history of Dungeons & Dragons. I know you guys have heard it a million times on the show, me talking about my history with my parents and the Satanic Panic and my mom burning my D&D books and all of that stuff. So to be able to, like, now as an adult, you know, that's in charge of his own damn life, to be able to look at this thing that tells this story of, like, of a game that has just been so pivotal and so important to me and so many of my friends is really amazing. Like, be sure to check this book out. Even if you're not buying it, like, go, you know, check it out from the library, find it, look at it. It's beautiful. It's amazing. It's worth your time. Arts and Arcana, Dungeons and Dragons, A Visual History. It's a beautiful book. Fascinating, amazing. Of course, if you want to know more about the show, you can visit our website, www.totlb.com, where you can find us on Instagram or Twitter at Outside Longbox, on the Facebooks at facebook.com/thinkingoutsidethelongbox. You can call the Michael Kirk Memorial Hotline, 970-573-6148. Leave us a message. I want to hear your D&D stories. That'd be great. Tell me about you, how much you love Dungeons and Dragons. And of course, visit us at patreon.com/TOTLB, where you can support this show. We'd love to have your support. We love the people that help us. You guys are amazing. And last but definitely not least, go to tinyurl.com/TOTLBtube to find our YouTube channel. There's been a lot of great stuff going on there, and you will probably catch a video of me talking about this book very soon, or last couple days ago, depending on when Juan brings us out. So anyway, with that said, I'm Gabe. This has been an interview episode of Thinking Outside the Long Box. We'll talk to you soon. Bye.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Thinking Outside the Long Box podcast. Join us on Facebook and Twitter to get behind-the-scenes information for exclusive content and to be notified when new episodes are available. The thoughts and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the individual and do not necessarily represent or reflect those of the Thinking Outside the Long Box podcast, Baron Space Productions, its partners, or affiliates. The Thinking Outside the Long Box podcast is made available by its creators, Juan, John, and Gabe. The podcast is edited and produced by Juan, and Albie is the co-executive producer. The Thinking Outside the Long Box podcast is a Baron Space production.